Welcome to the Monsters of Fantasy. This was written, produced, recorded, and edited by me, Sean McCarter. Monsters of Fantasy is a production in which I will explore the truly horrific side of the fantasy world known as Dungeons and Dragons. There are content warnings in the show notes below.
Episode 13. The Planetar.
Hello. So, I chose last week's selection for more than sentimental reasons. I found that statement during my research into the unknown gods, and the statement about the mummy gave us a lot to go off of. First, that jackal-headed man they saw painted on the walls was a description of Anubis, which makes sense if that temple was a temple of an ancient death cleric. I was in the library for days researching that name before I came across anything. Eventually, in a small footnote under a block of text about the history of Tabaxi, did I find that name in reference to the God of the Afterlife and Judgment. Now, that title is used to refer commonly to our god Kelimvor, but then I started doing more research on this God of Afterlife and Judgment, and admittedly, I almost gave up. That's why I didn't include any of this last week. I was just running out of time putting it all together, and I still don't have much of anything, but during that time I came across only one more mention of the names in reference to this god. There were three: Minos, Rhadamanthus, and Arcas, the context of which came from an old tome titled The History of King Athaphos I. Now, I doubt it's in an original. The original book was written well over 3,000 years ago, but in this specific version, when they discussed the god that judged Lord Athaphos worthy of a pantheon alongside Pelor, the god is instead referred to as three people. I asked Nico if he could make anything of it. He suggested that if I only found one copy amongst thousands that mentioned this weird unknown difference, then maybe it was merely a misprint. That didn't sit well with me, though, so I kept looking, and, well, I found something unsettling. Now, I can confirm one thing. The use of this spell that Nico created to take these stories from other people doesn't actually mean they can't lie, like the others have told me. It's hard to explain, but the story I'll be reading you today tells the events of something I happened to almost witness firsthand. And while this statement isn't lying, it does omit a few things. This was taken from Taliesin, a former bard to the king's court, and is the story of how our king summoned an angel. As the king's personal bard, I am sworn to some secrecy, but as I plan on adding this to my book eventually, I'll tell you a bit about that day. I will tell you all my oath will let me. Now, this incident isn't some secret. Hell, the king did it while in open court in front of almost 300 people. It's just none of them, aside from Durghal and Mountain Mover, were as close as I was to the, unraveling of reality. And no offense to them, but I don't think a snarky dragonborn, nor a hot-headed Goliath, could tell the story as best as I. So, if you're going to be retrieving a statement about that day, about the being the king called down from the heavens, then it should be I who gives it. I came to the king's court 15 years before that day, on trial for treason. I was found crossing the border from the northern side of the Aetherian Range. I honestly didn't expect to be stopped, but I guess when there's a war raging on, you shouldn't be trying to cross into enemy territory. I hadn't been trying to do anything treacherous. I was merely trying to go to the City of Beasts to, one, see if it was real, and two, use it for research on a story I was writing about two gnolls who fell in love, despite being in warring tribes. I'd heard that across the mountains in the ash-fallen lands there was a civilization of monsters who lived like we do. You hear all of the propaganda that is put out about them and how the evil Drow King is trying to take over Athaphos as a whole. I was more curious about the idea of full civilizations of monsters. However, that research never came. A few of the king's spies caught me scaling down one of the lower mountain ridges, and through a peaceful negotiation, I was brought before the king, pleading for my life. See, had I not been a scholar, or at least had not been carrying multiple personal written accounts of our country's history, then I may have been merely returned to the kingdom, maybe giving community service, but seeing as I had an entire enchanted bag of holding worth of notes on most major cities, they thought I was out to commit treason. And on this particular day, I had been brought to the king's court. The throne room was massive, especially compared to the cramped underground cells I had been restrained to the previous 3 nights. And I really do mean massive. It was said that the first king had the castle built in such a way that he could, from his throne, in a simple turn of his head, see the world around him. Which was true, but it was also built specifically with worshipping Pelor in mind. The throne room was long and thin, with giant walls of glass and gold concaving to a point. At one end was the king's throne, a large golden chariot carved down and melted into place. The seat itself was very decorative, but the designs in the latticework that was used for the backing of the throne were lost by the intricate ruby gemstones that filled every hole. Resting under the throne on top of a large white marble slab was a long red carpet that draped down the cascading steps and stretched to the other end of the hall to meet 2 massive golden doors. These doors led to a small holding room made of marble, but whether you are friend or foe, if you wish to have an audience with the king, then you'll do so by entering through those doors. However, on both sides of this long stretch to meet the king, there were towering rows of seats. The king was smart, and always saw fit to have a true council. These stone benches extended up on each side, but not enough that the people sitting on them at the very top would be seated higher than the king's throne. No, that spot was reserved for the 6 balconies jutting up the wall above him. I later learned that these were for either of the king's archmages or the constables that governed the army. If a foreign power was visiting, then it was customary for them to sit up there as well. However, on the morning of my trial for treason, no one was positioned on the balcony. They were completely empty, giving a perfect view of the famous mural painted onto the ceiling. If you haven't the chance to see it in person, it is quite beautiful. An entire story painted in vivid detail, telling how King Athelfos the Mighty, a champion of Pelor, led the great campaign to drive the Prince of Demons Orcus back to the Abyss. But seeing as my first time was seeing it under the intense pressure of trial for treason, a crime punishable by none other than death, I was not able to take in the full beauty of St. Alisan's painting. Seeing as I'm telling you all this now, I did manage to talk my way out of most of the punishment. I was able to convince the king and his court that I was just a measly bard traveling the world to write fanciful histories of each place I happened to visit. This was mostly true, and I explained why I had so much, albeit kind of useless, information about the various cities, big or small. The announcement of me being a writer caused the king to personally read a passage I had written. A rather rubbish one about the dwarven king Mithrin and how he once wrestled an owl bear. He found it funny, though. Began chuckling right there in front of me, and I almost saw up my pants, thinking the king was mad, and found the passage so laughably bad that he was going to kill me. He gave me an offer, though. I either become his personal bard, long enough to write the full history of the kingdom, or be executed. I guess at this point it probably sounds like I was his slave, and technically I was. I was magically bound through oaths of power and conviction to prevent me from causing treason. I couldn't even begin to speak words that would knowingly cause the kingdom harm without feeling like Mountain Mover himself was squeezing my skull. I had never gotten past accidentally saying a full word, much less a sentence. I was told if I managed to do so, I'd die from the mental shock sent to my brain. However, in exchange, I got access to everything. I got what a lore bard's own personal dream could ever be. Anything I wished to know, I got access to. But that did mean I had to produce results, and this country has more than 3,000 years' worth of history. But this isn't some story about me writing my book. No, this is the story of how our great king proved once again why it is he that leads this country. The Aesimar are touched by the gods, imbued with fragments of their strength. From their conception thousands of years ago, the Aesimar have been a beacon of good and holy. That's why the line of the king has been almost completely restricted to the Aesimar heritage. They believe that our king should be guided and chosen by the gods themselves. Now, I can't speak for the gods as a whole, but I am positive that Pelor has chosen our great King Kaiwen III. Now, if it was to rule over all of mankind, that I do not know, but the king has made it very apparent that Pelor was on his side personally. So, now that you know who I am, let me show you what happened on that fateful day. It was by chance you were in the castle that day. You had just gotten back from a trip to Bawai, and you were planning on sleeping in for the rest of the day, but Tristan, one of the king's archmages who you'd become pretty good friends with, informed you that we had just taken in a live demon as prisoner. He told you that they were going to be holding a special public council to discuss the findings. The king had long believed that the drow were working with the demons to try to overthrow Athafos, and you figured that today might be a catalyst in a campaign on a war on foreign soil. For the last 300 years, the war between other nations had been nothing more than isolated skirmishes or spy networks sneaking across the mountains. This was a breakthrough for our nation. If Tristan could prove that this demon had been working with the drow, it wouldn't be hard to convince the people of a war effort. You ask Tristan if he's going to attend or aid the king's decision on the matter, but he informs you that he and Vulcan's son, Volvis, will be going downstairs to pry out as much information out of the demon as possible. Knowing he wouldn't be there and figuring a crowded audience, you gather all your parchment and quills, and you take your seat at the best spot in the house, an archmage's balcony. The other balconies are filled, and sitting on the one to your left is Vulcane, an older, gaudy-looking elf, the archmage who specializes in divination magic. On the balcony adjacent to him is the last archmage, Sylvain. He's a middle-aged elf, and sitting next to him is his protege, Sparks. They both specialize in evocation magic. Across from you are the king's three constables. The oldest of the three is Percival. He sits across from you and is an older humanoid, wearing glistening golden full plate armor with two knights flanking him. The other two, Jormund, another human, and Greymane, a large muscular tabaxi, sit in the remaining balconies. The two are accompanied by faceless knights clad in armor, and they all have slight personalizations to their attire, but all of them are clad in ruby and gold. Then sits the king, high in his golden chariot of a throne. He has his two personal guards standing not far behind him. Durghul, a mercury dragonborn. He was wearing full golden plate mail and ruby-colored gems accenting his crimson-red scales. On his left was Mountain Mover, a towering full-blooded Goliath who is equally adorned in golden and red armor. Below, the stone benches are filled not with commoners, for they are always outside of the inner circle, but rather the rich denizens of Auron. 300 well-dressed citizens listen patiently as the magocracy decide the fate of their world. You stay quiet for the most part, while the proceedings go on for another 2 hours, and while you're no advisor, you do sit there and take very good notes. It was honestly kind of boring. Everyone seems to unanimously want to start a war with the drow. It was obvious that they needed to be stopped, and patience had been growing thin. But the fact that a high-ranking demon, a son of Orcus no less, had been captured, a war was inevitable now. The only stipulations were when, where, and how. These things, of course, will be decided later on in secrecy. So, thinking that you were almost nearing the end of a very long and tedious, but necessary, court proceeding, you started to pack up everything to go check out the torturing that was happening below. However, you kept your parchment out for the king's final speech. I want you to know we do not make this decision out of haste. My father before me was a great king. They called his reign of 120 years the most peaceful we have ever had. Even now as I speak, there are more statues of my father than there are of me. And I am no fool. He was a great man to broker the peace with our friends in Rakir. But my father let things go too far with the enemies to the east. My father grew complacent with the small victories. But our enemies are the kind who plot, and the kind to sneak. My father did not take after Kaiwan the First, who sought to fight them back. Many of you may not remember it because your families were not the ones fighting. But just 200 years ago, battles were held on our land, our soil. Go ask the citizens of Gogduval, who still have families who fought and lost their lives against the drow. The room goes quiet and everyone stirs uncomfortably in their seats. The king was standing at this point and raises his palms, almost grasping at the ceiling. And now, those same drow parley with the very scum that my ancestors died to rid this world of. Well, I will not make the mistakes of my father, and I will be known as the great King Kaiwan, because it was I who was chosen by Pelor to rule and lead us to victory against the blasphemous blight of our world. If the enemy is seeking aid from a demon, then I seek aid from the gods. The king's eyes start glowing with a bright, blinding shine as he shouted the words, light spewed from his mouth, blinding everyone. His hair whips wildly around his robes as a sourceless wind tunnels around him. His arms outstretched, he begins to beckon to Pelor. The light around the king starts to bend and shift, making it so he is outlined with the warping of reality. The edges of his frame are met with a bleeding ripple of colors and light as if the surroundings were breaking down into him. But they remained there. His chariot did not actually melt away, nor did the stones beneath his feet fall. However, the crowd is now in shock, some screaming and shouting. All of their faces begin to glow in a radiant light. You look up and the same reality-distorting light is now illuminating sourcelessly high above you, rapidly growing in intensity and size, seemingly eating away at the structured masonry behind you. But the bricks do not fall. From within the blinding light, you see thousands upon thousands of rippling waves. Your eyes start getting lost amongst the white chaos, but you are able to focus on one little crack, one silver lining in the sea of brightness that you try to follow as it seems to stretch on forever. The silver lining starts to widen and separate, revealing an equally blinding golden light. But now the light radiates you with a warm glow. You feel your face begin to melt away from the warmth, but you are not worried. You are calmed by the feeling. You watch as a giant invisible hand extends through the opening, and the only reason you even think it's a hand is because every time your eyes try focusing on it, the distortion in the light, it's shaped like a giant closed fist. And when you focus, it flickers constantly between shifting tones and textures, as if you saw 1,000 hands all moving and acting the same way, layered on top of one another. You try to begin to comprehend its size and capacity, but every time you try to witness this act of divinity, you feel as if your very hold on reality is slipping away. Instead, you just passively observe and watch as this distortion opens up, and from within side, white feathered wings begin to unfurrow. Walking out of the light is a tall emerald skin humanoid. The only thing that covers its hairless skin is the white silk fabrics it's wrapped around its torso. Wrapped around his neck is a thick golden chain that comes together in the shape of a blazing sun. The angel drops and implants a massive great sword into the ground as it lands gracefully, wings outstretched, onto the red carpet below. You now realize that this was the real Pelor. Not some illusion, not some astral projection. No, this was him. and he was leaving a piece of himself behind. You take your eyes off this angelic creature, but the radiant light is rapidly fading away, and everywhere it seemed reality was bent and ripped from its existence by the blinding light had seemingly become unaffected. The strong presence of radiant energy had faded away just as fast, but not completely. You watch as everyone, except the king, kneels to this creature. The king begins talking to this creature in a language you don't quite understand. The language of the gods. Celestial. But then, the creature responds not in celestial. It responded to you in Elvish. But you believe everyone heard it and understood what he had said.
Yes, King Kaiwan III, I will aid you in the destruction of those who shall tarnish your great nation of Pelor. I smell the demon you speak of. Please, let me go talk to him.
The creature's eyes flare with a golden flash, and as if almost on a cue, a deep rumble comes from deep within the castle. Everyone silently looks around, but before any discussion could be had, two more loud crashes come sounding, and for the first time after everything that transpired, a piece of stone dislodges from the ceiling. You think the demon that Tristan is torturing low below the castle has escaped. You see the slain flash of panic pass between the king and Vulcan's eyes, but the angel raises his hand as if he read the fears of the room.
It is only fitting I show you my strength. Let me go.
And with two running leaps, he threw himself out of the glass window of the castle. Everyone erupts into a chaos of limbs trying to push themselves out. The king's two royal guards had already grabbed the king and rushed him to his secret chambers. You, yourself, though, don't leave that spot. You sit there amongst the screams of the crowd, writing down everything you can remember. So, that's how that day was. I went to my private chambers, hidden safely in the castle. I didn't find out until the next day that it wasn't even the demon that had broken out. It was some guy they had locked away in the dungeon. Apparently a self-imprisoned lunatic under the name of Warren Joy broke out of his cell, flew crashing through two floors directly to his confiscated weapons, and then flew off on spectral wings into the crowded streets of Oron. The Planetar had found the prisoner, but did not pursue him. I never questioned the angel. I found it best to avoid him, honestly. I spent most of my life bending and shaping the truth of a narrative to fit my version of events. But when that creature's around, it knows the way I twist my words, and it knows when I'm trying to be deceitful. Instead, I stayed in the shadows, learning and writing the great history of Athelfos that was unfolding in front of me. End of story. This is not the intended entry for the Planetar. I would actually go as far to say this statement contains very little about the creature known as the Planetar. Maybe that's why I found it crumpled up in Nico's study. It makes sense, he just cares about the monsters. But it's here, and there's a lot I want to unpack from this. Let's get the entry out of the way first. The Planetar is a type of angel sent down by the gods in order to fulfill their duties. The Planetar is one of these angelic manifestations of a god's power on our mortal realm. I have seen others like the Diva, but the Planetar is one of the most assertive of the manifestations. It's odd, but this is the first celestial creature that we're putting down as a monster, so I guess it's fitting. This thing may only be seen as a savior if you follow the path of their god. These beings are used for war just as much as they are used for healing. The presence of one of these great beings is something magnificent to behold. And I should know. But these creatures can also be harbingers of misery. I was one of the, people who ran in after the commotion of that day. Actually, I was the cause of the crashing sounds I think they heard coming from below. See, it wasn't my intentions, but at the time of the events of this story, I was having my first encounter with a person named Warren Joy. Only recently did I make the connection to the very first statement I did a few months ago, but I had met Warren Joy almost 15 years before, in an underground cellar of the castle. My friends and I recently helped them capture the demon they're speaking of, Sylvain, son of Orcus. But while we were down there, my friend Erythoras provoked Warren Joy and caused him to break free of his confinement and, well, crash his way flying through several floors of stone. Also, Taliesin briefly talked about the Ashlands. I'm sorry to say, though, that the most I know about them is what this story tells us. We've been at war with them for about 300 years or so. It's a shame, because I think a lot more research could be put into the Monster Manual's more mundane entries like goblins or gnolls if we could observe these societies that function similar to ours. I might bring it up to Nico if he's willing to sneak into enemy territory one day. I'm getting off topic, though. This is a recording for the Monster Manual. Physiology. The Planetar is a large, muscular, and hairless winged creature. They have opalescent emerald-green skin and golden eyes. They stand roughly 9 feet tall and are towering to most normal humanoids. They are creatures of power, strength, and speed. They are, in the broadest sense, peak physical perfection, as they should be considering they are supposed to be the right-hand warriors of the gods. But though they may descend from the immortals, they themselves can be killed. As pulled from some of the other statements that detail more about the monster, here are its weaknesses and resistances. First, the Planetar is completely immune to being charmed or frightened. We'll go over more why in its extensive abilities list, but just know that neither will work on this celestial creature. Because of its otherworldly origin, it is resistant to any attacks made by mundane weapons, as well as attacks that originate from a celestial origin themselves. This covers almost any damaging spell that causes radiant damage. Other than that, though, the Planetar can and will bleed if attacked. It wouldn't be very unwise to do so, without the aid of either magical items of a legendary stature, or a group of seasoned adventurers. Attacks and abilities. First is the Planetar's telepathy. We're going to call this its divine awareness, and in part I think is the reason why it can't be charmed or frightened. The Planetar knows all languages and can speak to them telepathically. But that is not all. The Planetar knows when it has heard a lie. Actually, it doesn't stop at hearing, either. This extends to sight as well. The Planetar can see through all illusions and deceptions with its almost godlike omnipotence. They also have been given spells like their lesser cleric brethren. Now, this can vary, it seems, across the different Planetars, but it seems all of them can detect the presence of good and evil as well as turn invisible completely on a whim. At the snap of a finger, they can bring rain to raise a crop field or send an insect plague to wipe one out. But that isn't even their most deadly ability. No. The deadliest ability lies in their uncontrollable energy that flows through them. Having the literal power of God, any time the Planetar strikes with its weapon, it releases its pent-up radiant energy, blasting the target with immense force. I can say with experience and through some of these other stories that the energy it releases on accident when it strikes is enough to kill any mortal man 5 times over. I guess to make up for it, though, the Planetar can hand out life just as easily as he can take it. He has an ability to cure an individual of almost any ailment or disease that is affecting them. However, it doesn't just stop there. It will also mend and restitch any non-fatal wounds, even as going as far to cure the blind and deaf. Well, end of entry. Okay, so when Taliesin tried to behold the image of Pelor, and he mentioned the flickering of like 1,000 hands, I think there has to be something there in connection with the previous statement. I haven't brought any of this up with Nico yet. I just know he's going to be cryptic or misleading. I'm trying to find someone to talk to about all of this. Daisy has been back and around the castle, but Nico has her doing artifact storage with Luna. The two have been busy cataloging our magic items, and admittedly, when I brought this up to them, they didn't really seem to care. Cadwin at least humors me by reading the stuff and listening to me about it. His theory is that the gods these clerics are worshipping are just like energy, and that over time the name or shape of that energy changes. But that still doesn't sit well with me. I've met Kelimvor, okay? I have very powerful friends, and, well, when we ran into him on the plains of Elysium, I can assure you he did not have a jackal head. Hey, Luna. Can you cast Sending to a friend of mine? Arithras, the dragonborn I was telling you about?
Thank you. If you enjoyed today's episode, please share it with your friends and family, or leave a rating on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at monstersof_ for all news and teasers for upcoming episodes. Today's story was the result of an in-game week-long campaign that my players were having against the son of the demon prince Orcus. The entire time, the party's cleric had been trying to successfully use their own divine intervention. I jokingly decided to roll a D100 for our king, and this story is the result of our first ever divine intervention. Join me next week as we continue with the story from one of our players that set Warren Joy free, as she tells us the horrors of the Maraz Eye. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.